Thank you, Dr. Max. Thank you very much. It's a really nice introduction. And isn't it a most wonderful day, friends, to be South African today? I can just imagine the children who are going to be named Cameron and Chad and Chris Kiriras to go down the road. And I also hope by the end of the Olympics that there are many little Custers and Oscars and that guy who rides his BMX so wonderfully. I think it's a fine, fine day. So I'm going to start. It may look to you like I've lost my way. I'm very honored to be here, to honor a man, to do a lecture in his name of somebody who practiced his freedom and fought for it when it was a much, much tougher thing to do. So it's going to feel good to you for moments like I've lost my way here, like I'm talking about stuff that you didn't come to hear. But trust me, I'll get there eventually. My key point is, like Amartya says, that development is freedom, and that's the entire theme of my discussion. So there'll also be music in bits, and I hope that you can help me identify this first song. Thanks for finding the sound button. So that's Slicker, and his song has caused a stir. It's called Blacks Are Fools, and let me tell you, in some circles that some of you know, it's caused a stir that's almost bigger than the spear. And his premise is this, is that 18 years after freedom's come, what the hell? Why is life still so bloody difficult for the black majority? Is it apartheid? Is it colonialism? Or is it incompetence and corruption of this, our government? It's probably all three. The message is very clear to me in that song. Development is freedom. Without development, there is no freedom. So by 2014, when we celebrate 20 years of democracy, where will we be? Here's another view to Slickers, and it's brought to us by the analyst J.P. Lundman, who I heard speaking last week. He's a guy who enjoys shooting down conventional thinking. And JP's core thesis is this. The country is wealthier and has achieved better rates of growth than the apartheid state managed in the final two decades of its rule. In his words, these are not mine, so it turns out the darkies are way better at governing than the whiteies. It has used this money well. There are now about 16 million people on grants of some kind. For me, a meaningful form of Ubuntu. It's kept our country stable and has given poor people a strong sense of dignity, and it is, for me, a form of democracy. Our money managers have done this so well that they've kept these social welfare payments at a constant 3.7% of GDP while pushing up the number consistently to reach the 16 million. We are not a welfare state by any measurement. So if you add to this the substantial public housing stock that's been built over the past 20 years, and well, Slicker may be wrong, although I wouldn't say that in front of him. It's said often that revolutions in the arts, a reawakening, a flourishing, reflects the growth of nations, the progress of countries. So where are we? In film, there's Othello burning, there's spray hate, intersections, man on the ground, there's a Western being shot in the Karoo. There's global casting to play the role of Mandela, it didn't go to a local person. There's the makers of Ukama Nkarlitsha doing La Boheme, I believe. Cape Town, as I'm sure you well know, continually makes the list of the world's coolest cities, and we all understand why. And then there's this. I also think they're awful, but maybe some of them don't. And that's the Unworked, last seen, I think, making advertisements in New York and being thrown through adoring crowds. So what the Americans make of your masterpiece in the first place, look, I'm not quite sure. I'm not there really. But the Unworked is part of a long list that I scribble on a lot because I'm doing a book about it. of South Africans who are making it very large on the world stage. So here's our list, yeah? Some of it at least. All know him? That's last night. Cameron, night before, two nights before. Nelson Mandela, the Arch, George Bezos, Winnie. Whenever I put her up, people don't always agree, but still I do. Elon Musk, Himla Sudhya, there's Vera, Herman Mashaba, the Working for Water Program won many awards, and then of course the SK Bird, headed by Naledi Pandor and by Bernie Fanerov. So my list is very long, and it's an effort by City Press to see to alter how we South Africans see and understand ourselves, not through the blinkered lenses that we often don, and also to deal with the people in audiences like this one who always ask me, so why the hell doesn't the media tell the good news? There it is. We're now up among the nations that will matter by virtue of our membership of the BRICS group of countries. And then this woman won a BET award recently. I think she's phenomenal. That's Lira, but I'm sure you all knew that. We also have highways, which put India to shame. I've traveled there and know this. We have growing ports that are getting better for growing exports, even though the economy is down. We have rail links that are shaping the economy in radical new ways. And there's about R1 trillion going to be spent on new infrastructure to build towns around the commodities deposits with which we are so blessed. Some of these include titanium, platinum, steel, gold, and I'm sure that these prices will bounce right back, although we know where they are. Now, the next slide is going to get me into trouble, as it does in academic audiences. ShopRite will, I predict, give Walmart a run for its money if the government ever allows Walmart to start operating. And who knows, maybe we'll even get 4G broadband if we get that particular act together. This economy is not a basket case, neither is our country, and that's not by accident. Our economic managers, Praveen Gordhan, Trevor Manuel, a very young Trevor Manuel, Jill Marcus, and Lesetia Haniyahu, are absolutely world-class financial managers, and I think they've done us well. Geography also helps us. Of our modern history trying to pretend that we weren't at the tip of Africa, suddenly it's the south of a continent of growing hope. Africa is a continent home to 7 of the world's fastest growing economies. Broadband is bringing down the cost of doing business, as is democracy across sub-Saharan Africa. On education and health here back at home, I do see some strides. The matric pass rate is ticking up steadily, and possibly not improbably, even though the week is filled with calls to get rid of the education minister, and we started testing again at grades 3, 6, and 9. These are good things. That's the one side of the story, but there is a very, very sad side to the story as well. A few months ago, my colleague at City Press, Sipho Masondo, who works in Limpopo, uncovered the textbook shortages at a school where he noticed that the students were, well, singing all day because they didn't have anything else to do. So he thought that either they're training the next Ladysmith Black Mambazo, or we are training hewers of wood and drawers of water. These are images from the Eastern Cape and from Limpopo. Inadvertently, I wondered, have we created a system like Bantu education, as well as Malpela has also written about this very often, which stunts hope and which kills dreams? I suspect that we have, Because what we have now are 3 million young people who are unemployed and largely unemployable. The system is disgorging at least 100,000 new graduates a year, a tiny percentage of whom we found will make any lives of meaning in the new democracy. So with the pass rate set at 30%, I think we're seriously kidding our young people when we tell them that this might make them ready for a life of meaningful work or even of entrepreneurship. In fact, this world that we know here is pretty inaccessible, unpredictable, and unreachable. That picture was taken this year. It breaks my heart every time I see it. So add to the 3 million young people, the adult unemployed, and yes, Moeletsi and Mbeki may well be right. By 2024, could there be large-scale rebellion here? Perhaps another revolution. I think that unless we don't get our young people into work, into the system, and offer them lives of hope, that may very well be a reality. I think that the angry youth bulge is perfectly unsustainable, and it's not going to be placated by grants as the older generation has been. And not when you can see through the looking glass at our worlds of privilege that still make ours very much an apartheid landscape. So last week, we were surprised again at a World Bank report which found that if we don't address inequality, the key index, we're not going to achieve inclusive growth or a generalized prosperity in South Africa. The numbers are pretty grotesque. The reality of a Gini, that's the Gini coefficient, the measure of wealth, is with us already. And if you don't believe us, have a look at the following images. Pretty grotesque. There's beautiful Gautrain. And there's a recently burnt metro rail because it never lives on time, so people burnt it. There's Denfern. And there's Dipsworth. They really do reside right next to each other. That's the Maponya Mall in Soweto. Soweto is a proper city. And that's Orange Farm in Soweto at a protest earlier this year. Clifton. And the flats. So there's already a rebellion about this kind of gross inequality underway. Every day there's a protest or two somewhere. By mid-June, the municipal IQ had already notched up over 700 protests this year. That's well over two a day. Our reporters suggest that IQ is not counting Mpumalanga, the Free State, and other deep rural areas, so it may even be higher than that. It's happening already. But the only time that we in the urban centres noticed is when the flames flick too close to home. Why? Why are people so angry? Well, for one, it's winter, electricity costs are rising, and water is not putting out fires but causing them. Blueouts, that's water cutoffs across Mpumalanga and the Free State, are the new matchsticks. So are jobs, people are desperate for work. So is tender corruption, unbuilt police stations, poor councillors who are more interested in blue lights than sewage pipes themselves, electricity, and toilets. The stuff that I guess most of us in this lecture room take for granted is still not a common asset across our country. Of course, some of this is legacy. Apartheid's spatial geography has made transport costs extremely high. Much of the discouraged workforce, and there are millions of people who have simply given up looking for work, have done so because taxi fares are too expensive for them to afford. Globalization and integration into a global economy has meant that the petrol price yo-yos, as we know. Food prices have shot up. An apartheid-era subsidized electricity is gone, so power has been increasing. Still, I find that the laying of structural blame, of blame on structural economy, on an inchoate enemy, and on capitalism in general, as our government has taken to doing, is simply disingenuous. I often wonder when I hear people speak, but where have you been? You cannot now claim that hoary old chestnut of having been in power, of having been in office but not in power. What have you been doing for 18 years? I think President Jacob Zuma did a very fine version of this on Rudy Direko's show last week when he said that, well, Hendrik Verwoerd was to blame for the textbooks that hadn't been delivered to Limpopo schools. Luisa Gola says Limpopo is the place textbooks go to die. So Verwoerd will be responsible for a long time yet for very many things. But as the ANC pointed out at its weekend, the Hotla, the textbook failure, and I think it's a symbol of something much greater, is a failure of government, our government, at two levels, both provincial and national. And last week's Auditor General's report revealed that Terence Nombembele revealed just how much of this failure is made by us. If audits are a measure of how well we spend public money, then clearly there's a problem. Consultants are keeping councils up in many, many places because our officials lack even the basic qualifications to run municipalities. We're paying twice, basically, for staff who are supposed to be doing the job. And how do we know all of this about our country? So who here regularly reads or has read Vukuzenzele? Nobody. Yet it is the newspaper in South Africa with the highest print order. It's the government's account of opportunities and the good news. Last time I checked, there were thousands of undistributed copies at my post office, and at yours too, I'm sure. Chances are that you know what you do because you consume media in South Africa. Countries with free medias don't have famines, but they do have crises. In most every audit of South Africa, our free and robust media comes out right on top. So you can imagine my surprise at feeling how I did earlier this year when we had done what we do, which is to report well. I realized then, so this is what it feels like when your freedom starts to go. I felt a pinching around my throat. Nobody had their fingers around me, but for days and days the words just wouldn't come out. And when they did, it was as if to engage in a dialogue with the deaf. So this, I thought, is what it feels like when freedom starts to go. As Jacques said earlier, whenever the histrionic among us have declared that free expression is on the skids, I've poo-pooed them. Nonsense. These were the iterations, the words of either the young or the previously privileged or the hysterical who had lived through those days and keep claiming wrongly that apartheid repression is making a comeback. It's a tiresome hysteria because honestly you can't compare then with now, not at all. I still don't think that it's a fair comparison, but independently I feel my freedom being eviscerated. I know what an absence of freedom feels like because I've lived then and I live now. And don't laugh at my head, please. So I grew up in Bosmond, an apartheid group area, among people who looked like me, spoke like me, and believed like me. They were the same color as me, the same class, and of the same destiny. It was social engineering I realized only much later, a form of Nazism, surely. It's only through the hard work of working class parents that we were able to evade the destiny of the clothing factory, where both my parents started and ended their working lives, or the destiny of leaving school in what is now grade 10 and becoming a school teacher to then reinforce the cycles of colored destiny again and again and again. My young life was one long trip to escape group areas' clutches. My brothers had to change identity several times, so my mother had mine inscribed Indian and Cape Malay to ensure that she didn't again have to alter the age of a kid. Only now does it strike me as odd that we had to keep moving and moving, and that the serial retrenchments my father suffered were an outcome of a corrupted destiny. Only now do I understand the benefits of inherited privilege and how much our country, had to overcome to be free. My sense of freedom's potential came when I joined the organizations fighting the Group Areas Act. By the time I became a journalist, it was only a continuation of this fight, and we worked through times that were decidedly unfree. Information flows were opaque, corruption endemic. Not for a moment do I buy the view that the apartheid state was somehow less corrupt than the democratic state. I think it's rubbish. We simply did not know. Privilege inherited and risk was real. So these guys knew well. Donald Woods, Percy Poboza, Matata Tseru, Joe Tlolwe, Raymond Lowe, Can Temba. Our risk was that set out above, but theirs was much deeper. Ours was occasionally getting shot at, chased by police dogs, being lied to, and being censored but not killed. So journalism has always been a quest for freedom for me. And I have loved reporting since 1994, writing and later editing in ways I hope have been fair to the new country, to its every gain and its every pain. I still don't think we do the gains enough, which is why I started as I did. For me, corruption has been the deepest, deepest pain. That greed showed its face so very, very quickly. And the clutch of power proved terribly fast and terribly seductive. So at Parliament, I remember a trade union leader turned arms negotiator asking, "So lady, do you want to ride in a great big plane?" I think you are serious, but I said no. "Not really," I replied, wondering if he realized that we were all going to be taken for a great ride that would mark the first large-scale abuse of public funds and mark us as seduced by the world's wily ways. Now, that arms deal corruption feels very small compared with what we deal with almost every week. When it's all counted, I think you'll find that Limpopo has been looted by billions of rands, a price paid in absent textbooks, roads which crumble, and the like. What we discount is the cost on development of corruption, perhaps an extension of Amartya Sen's work. Perhaps it should be a logical follow to his work to then calculate, if development is freedom, what is the cost to that development of corruption? And what I'd now like to focus on is the impact of corruption on freedom, on our freedom, on my freedom. I'm sad that this year my journalism is perhaps best known for the spear. The biggest battles we fought at two papers on freedom of expression have been about uncovering corruption. They've been about the National Police Commission, Jackie Selebe, the Youth League President, Julius Malema, the Scorpions, the SABC, and of late, the Lieutenant General Richard Mdluli. Each of these instances has been about corruption, alleged then, often proven later, where free expression becomes a direct threat to eating. You win some and you lose some. Through each, I think freedom is constrained as cost mount, and the freedom of journalism is constrained by the language of legal fairness. But oftentimes, freedom has won. The courts have struck definitive blows against pre-publication interdicts again and again. But the sphere was, for me, a whole different ballgame, and I come out in a different era. That's the sphere. I think the artist is in the house somewhere. I have no doubt that the fight about this was an easy comeuppance for a media with which the governing party is often at odds because it dislikes the mirror which we hold up to our society. It was about corruption too. The entire theme of Hail to the Thief, Brett Murray's exhibition, was about the seductions of power, or what the ANC calls the sins of incumbency. There's a fist raised in Amandla and slammed down in repression. I wanted to buy that one, but it got sold very quickly. There's the ANC for sale and the ANC sold. The bastardization of epic struggle posters to prove a point. We have a long history of art that has troubled power, and I'll take you through some of it. I don't remember all the artists. I hope you can see clearly. Nelson Mandela, this image was banned back in the day. You couldn't publish it. Around 1976, a piece of art like this being published could have gotten editors into big trouble. This is one of the few times when Thabo Mbeki was satirized. This is Chief Albert Luthuli as the Black Jesus. Stephen Cohen being evicted from a monument, I forget which one. Zanele Moholi's photographs, which saw the arts minister, the former arts minister, now women's minister, leaving an exhibition that she had sponsored. This was about identity and race. The ashtray shaped like a vagina. That was about Jacob Zuma and many kids. The conga at the time of the rape trial. This was the autopsy of Mandela. This one is interesting for me in that it deals with circumcision, but it sits in the KZN Art Gallery, and it's seen, often it's used as a teaching tool for young people to tell them about why circumcision is so important in the fight against HIV infection. And then there's this one by Cape Town's own Ayanda Mabulu. I wonder why this image didn't get the artist a near lynching. On the left, your left, yes, is Jacob Zuma. And on the right is the beloved Archbishop. Big statements in there. Why the SACP leader and higher education minister Blaine Nzimande didn't object to this one. So when Nzimande stood up at an NUM conference and made the first boycott call against City Press, I felt my freedom being constrained. Later the same day, the ANC's Jackson Mthembu did the same thing. What many don't know is that the ANC and the presidency had realized by then that their case was extremely weak, and they played a large part in getting the urgent interdict they had sought taken off the court roll, and they immediately went to the streets to call for a boycott. We were played grandly. So thank you for those of you who went out to buy more than one copy. We're very grateful. So we laugh now, but then at that moment I really felt the future. So when next a political scapegoat is needed to hang a political campaign on, the media will be fair game, especially if you're big and if you're black like City Press is. We almost became the focal point of a presidential campaign for re-election. 2 days later, the paper was burned in a march led by one of the first ladies, paid for by our tax money, and attended by the political and business literati. 3 days later, the paper was boycotted. Then, a day later, I took the image down off our website because its publication and its dissemination had opened up a deep and collected woundedness. It had shown me a dignity as fragile as a piece of dove-shaped origami. It was, I said at the time, a decision I had taken as an olive branch, extended in citizenship. A lesson I learned from your Pumla Kobodo Marikizela, who has revealed time and time again the power of reaching out across seemingly insurmountable barriers, the power of love over hate, the power of standing down for the greater good. But it was also because, let me be frank, because City Press had been burnt, I had been insulted, and so my freedom died a little, taken by my own hand, but also by the hand of the Film and Publications Board. That body is meant really to protect children from harmful content. In that week, I saw it morph into a political handmaiden. In about 20 hours of hearings, the screeching limitations of paid deployment were writ loud. From the CEO to the spokesperson, to the classifiers whose names you can't know, their minds were made up long before the hearing we insisted upon with the gallery. And this was the outcome, a classification of 16 for nudity on a painting the second time. This was a predetermined outcome, which had almost nothing to do with protecting children. It was done to satisfy political masters. I felt my freedom evaporate as I realized, so this is how it happens. You hollow out institutions, you stack them with deployed cadres, you politicize the bureaucracy, you create an enemy, and then you mount a populist cause. Achieving freedom took very many decades, and it took thousands of lives, but it takes very, very little to kill it. I think the Auditor General's report shows us something similar, that you can have the same effect when you harm institutions from the inside. You can impact on development as freedom. And then I saw it in action again at a set of parliamentary hearings into transformation in the print industry, where, abetted by ideologically hidebound academics and by government minstrels, the committee fired the next shot across the bow of free expression. There have been many. If you stack the institution with cadres, if you close the space for independent thinkers, and if you mount a populist cause, you inevitably harm freedom. The upshot of all of this is that I am a changed person. I'm less a child of Mandela's generation than I used to be, and more freedom of expression fundamentalist. I would not take down that image today, knowing what I do now. That power of love, of standing down, of reconciling to a greater good, has withered in my eyes, and it's been made to wither by a failed and flailing leadership, by men and women who are shadows of the people who led us into the democratic era. This fundamentalism I recognize as not being terribly healthy. No fundamentalism ever is. But through this and other episodes in the years of freedom, I've come to understand that this lifeblood is so easily and so quickly undermined that you have to be extremely vigilant to protect its fragility, which, like our dignity, is also just paper thin. So 18 years after apartheid officially died, where are we? Where are we after a policy that was akin to ethnic cleansing, in the depths of its depravity and in its generational impact? It was evil, and it was determinedly so. A policy to stunt a people, to stunt cognition, to stunt ambition, to stunt esteem, and to embroider inferiority into the soul. That's the court that's meant to undo all that harm. The spear showed me how very successful that policy has been, that a common and shared national dignity is still such an elusive thing, and that a painting, a rendition only, an interpretation, could uncork such deep, deep hurt so very, very quickly. I'm much more deeply saddened that the inheritors of a fine movement can find no clever ways of leading us from where we are. But I'm deeply heartened that civil society is showing the way in fantastic ways. Our civil society is unbending in its principle and its commitment to this land. There's the launch of Mampela Rampele's movement. Note how the Social Justice Coalition entered with the Freedom Under Law for a court application to have the corrupt Lieutenant General Richard Mbluli suspended pending his prosecution on attempted murder and corruption charges. Because of that, we've got ourselves a whole new National Police Commissioner. Notice too how the Right to Know campaign has kept MPs' feet to the fire, in fact kept all our feet to the fire, on the Protection of State Information Bill. Notice how Section 27 and Equal Education have forced us to stop making a molehill of a mountain and to call an education crisis a crisis rather than a late delivery. And I think this is why the song explains it.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
So South Africans are hysterically and notoriously chatterach people. I know. So having been told off by hundreds of people for putting up the spear in the first place, I was then smacked by other hundreds for taking it down again. I think we're a nation in constant and passionate chatter, and that makes us a little Nigerian in the, shall we say, robustness of our discourse. We take our democracy extremely seriously. As we should. It's a precious and hard-won thing, and I have no doubt that we will ensure its protection and its longevity, like this guy said that we should.
Never and never again shall it be that this beautiful love will again experience the oppression of one by another.
I'm a free speech fundamentalist, but I have no worries about the state of our freedom 18 years on. I think there are some minutes for questions. Thanks so much.